www.thegoldenbeard.com or visit their store on 229 East Georgia Street in Chinatown. They are open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Wednesday to Saturday and 12 to 5 from Sunday to Tuesday. Their friendly staff would love to give you a hand to find your new favorite read.
Tune your radio to the CITR 101.9 FM on a Tuesday, specifically at 1 p.m. or 11 p.m. for saxophone Hello Primiti or saxophone La Nuit. Hosted by moi, accompanied with the improvisationalists, saxophonists, composers, and musicians of our great era. Anthony Braxton, Albert Ehler, Solange, Ghostface Killah, Ornette Coleman, Sonny Rollins. That's 1 p.m. or 11 p.m. on a Tuesday to listen to saxophone a la Primiti or saxophone La Nuit.
Storytelling is powerful. Our stories carry personal and collective histories, build bridges of understanding, and shine light on unseen truths. Your story, your voice, your power. CITR and Discorder is excited to announce the release of 5 unique podcasts as a part of its Power and Voice podcast incubation program. Power and Voice is an entry-level educational program created by CITR to surpass traditional barriers to entry into the medium of spoken word radio and podcasting. The result is a series of podcasts demonstrating a wide diversity of work in genre, structure, and content. Tune in every day from April 14th to 18th from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. to hear Power and Voice storytellers share their stories on their own terms and in their own words.
Welcome to the Artbeat, formerly the Arts Report on CITR 101.9 FM. Today is Wednesday, April 9th, and we are finishing off our limited series, Everything But the Piece, and live broadcasting to you today from the University of British Columbia Vancouver campus, our event, Everything But the Panel. First and foremost, we'd like to acknowledge that UBC is the unceded ancestral lands of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people, whose traditional territory once spanned roughly 1,500 square kilometers. Today, the Musqueam Reserve is just under 3 square kilometers. The land here was never given up to the Crown, but was rather stolen without plans for reparation. This is reflected today by the University Endowment Lands, which occupies over 4 times the size of the Musqueam Reserve. UBC itself played a major part in these histories. Being part of the Arts Collective at CITR and being able to be here talking about art and culture in this space is a privilege, and we seek to create meaningful dialogue, uplift disenfranchised voices, and disrupt institutional knowledge production in the small ways that we can. Art, music, and media, including radio, are all inherently political, and as Indigenous voices in so-called Canada have been systematically devalued and diminished from these spaces, we'd like to point you to the great work of Unceded Airways from CITR's Indigenous Collective. Today, we are joined by our lovely panelists, who I will introduce in no particular order. We have Juniper from Out on the Shelves, Alifa, a faculty member of the Gender, Race, Sexuality, and Social Justice Department here at UBC. We have Naomi and Audrey from Music Waste, Nico from CITR, Aliza from Antarcus, and Mungo from Grey Labs. So I'll pass it over to all of you to just introduce yourselves a little further, and we'll get started with our discussion for today about art and resistance.
All right.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
My name's Aliza. with a bunch of friends, and we're just a collective that, you know, is dedicated to exploring the intersections between art, activism, and community.
Hi there, my name is Mungo. I'm a photographer and the founder and owner of Grey Lab YVR. We are a underground live music venue, and we host pretty much everything under the sun, so that's kind of my thing.
Two mics now, terrifying. I'm Juniper, my pronouns are they, them, and I'm here from Out on the Shelves. We are the oldest and largest queer library in Vancouver. We're community run, all volunteers, and we've been around since 1983.
Thank you everyone for being here and for having me. I am Nicolas Serrano La Paz. I am part of CITR. I also come from Mexico City, which used to be Tenochtitlan. And I'm part of CITR, and I do a lot of organizing work. I wouldn't say on the side, but sort of like as part of my job, part-time job at the Bike Kitchen. And then I also do art, which I would term, for me, I term multidisciplinary poetry. Yeah, it's picking up. I'm exhibiting at Youth Ignite Fest, so that's exciting. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Alifa. I teach in GRSJ, which is Gender, Race, Sexuality, and Social Justice. But yeah, what a pleasure to be here with you all who are doing really incredible work.
Hi, my name is Naomi. My pronouns are she, they. I am this year's administrative coordinator at Music Waste. It's my third year organizing there, and we're on our 31st year, and we're an independent, grassroots, anti-institution music festival runs locally, promoting the DIY scene. I'm also co-president here at CITR.
I'm Audrey. I use she, they pronouns. I'm venue coordinator for Music Waste this year, and I am vice president of CITR this year.
I use they, them pronouns, by the way.
All right, great. Thank you. Thank you so much for all of those lovely introductions. We'd like to hear a little bit more about your personal interpretation of our key theme today. So I'm just going to open it up. Sorry about that mild disruption, everyone. I hope all of our ears are still okay. I'm just gonna, oh, are we all good to continue or? All right, I'm just gonna restart there. So we just wanna get your kind of personal takes and, you know, interpretations of our main theme today. So we just wanna open it up and ask you, what does art as resistance mean to you? And you can kind of include your personal backgrounds and experiences there. Feel free to kind of jump in any order, whatever kind of comes to mind.
Okay, hey, guess I'll start. Art as resistance for me is taking the things that people who work in institutions find very unpleasant and uncomfortable and putting it right in their face in a medium that is able to be received very broadly. Often I find that when there are certain issues such as, you know, Israel, Palestine, many people like to bury their heads in the sand, and then when you put like large murals or just works all over, it's hard for them to ignore. And that's kind of what it means for me.
I think adding on to that, art, I feel like, is something that, you know, transcends all like language barriers, something that like we all, that's very innate to us and we all have access to and understand. For me, I see it as like a powerful tool of resistance that, you know, like when reports that are biased can't convey like a meaning, art and storytelling, that's like, you know, artists have always been on the forefront of like any movement. And it's funny because they literally had nothing to lose. We're like broke half the time. But that's why we like, you know, artists are like powerful in that way, because they don't like, they're not confined by any of the societal, you know.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I don't think I said earlier, but I'm the vice president and volunteer director at Out on the Shelves. Anyway, details. Thinking specifically about my work at Out on the Shelves and thinking about a library, the power of stories and queer film and stories in particular is incredibly powerful as forms of resistance. Fiction allows us to imagine better futures. It allows us to imagine different ways of living and existing, and that is incredibly powerful, especially if you're, you know, growing up a queer, isolated kid.
It's so lovely to go after people who shared so much, because then I can bounce off that. Art as resistance to me is multifaceted. It's very difficult to kind of like navigate that. I feel like a lot of the times, especially in academic settings, we tend to, I wouldn't say throw around the word resistance, but it's definitely applied very expansively. And so to me, art as resistance is more of a question, like how is art resistance and art as resistance? It brings to mind what it is we are resisting, and then that brings to mind how it is that we resist. And I'm very much about, well, criticality in the sense of, is the art we're making truly resisting, or is it enabling, or is it continuing? These are difficult questions, and I don't think there's like one answer, but that's sort of like what I grapple with. And I just wanted to bounce off when we talk about transcending barriers, and Juniper, when you were talking about like the power of story, I'm thinking about Lee Miracle, wrote an indigenous author, poet, academic scholar. She wrote this piece called Oratory, Coming to Theory, in which she talks specifically about that and the power of story, an accessible medium that holds life itself. When we read academic articles or we read essays or books, it's a little bit disentangled from the embodied realities which we live. And art is very, very much grounded in a specific perspective and feeling. And I feel like that in itself, when we live in a world that is focused on efficiency and categorization and sort of like determining A and B so we can say that A is better than B, it's very important to give weight to that personal thing. I kind of went on a little bit of a spiral, but yeah.
Well, if I could just jump in, I really appreciated those questions that you just raised, Nico, and I kind of want to open it up to the floor about what limitations do you consider art resistance to have, and how can resistance movements avoid the pitfalls of normative institutional practices? We just want to keep that in mind in our discussion.
Yeah, I might, if it's okay, jump in. I think I represent the institution because I work as faculty here, and I think that's why I'm so, one, just your generosity to have a number of voices and folks in different sort of fields or different sort of ways of thinking about art, the institution, resistance, and politics because of how messy it all is. But I think how necessary these conversations are. I think I'm always quite illuminated by the work people are doing, but sometimes that gets lost within an institution or a university because of how sanitized, you know, ideas. Nico, I'm thinking about some of what you also just gestured towards as well, and I really appreciate you drawing attention to the work of Miracle. Because it's through, you know, some of these figures that we become familiar with who are not just these ideas or theories. They're people, they're, you know, part of embodied experiences, but they're artists, they're political, you know. And I think thinking about the multiplicity of how people live really can sort of afford art as transcending the institution, but also where maybe that resistance is made to feel a little bit more real as well, or how we might understand it in so many different ways.
Yeah, and feel free to go in any order. Just kind of, we want to have a collaborative conversation here. So whenever there's something you want to say, just feel free to. Yeah, just feel free to jump in. Yeah, yeah. Just everyone ignore that really quickly.
It's resisting to speak.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
I'm all hot. Oh. Is it?
Testing. Oh.
Hello?
Okay.
I was just hopping in so that we wouldn't sit in the silence post-speaker. but yeah, I just wanted to, like, how do we do it? It's a question to grapple with. I really think about, I wrote a poem recently in which it's like, what do my poems say that I cannot do with my hands? Mm-hmm. And I think about that a lot. Like, it's like, why am I engaging in this practice, and why am I choosing this practice instead of another? Or where does my energy go? And I'm thinking specifically of this someone who's known as the founding father of Palestinian cinema, I won't be able to pronounce this, but Hani Jawharieh, probably super mispronounced. But there's, can you say Maria? Jawharieh. Thank you so much. A short called Palestine in the Eye, which is directed by Mustafa Abu Ali. And it's about the footage that this founding father of Palestinian cinema, Hani, said, well, filmed. and he was filming actual fighters from the Palestinian Liberation Organization, from the PLO, and he died filming them. And he was there, and he was fighting alongside them. And he died filming the last moments, and he was told, like, I want to leave. And he said, no, like, my role, my job here in this resistance, in this specific path of resistance, is to be with them and to be on the ground. And I get chills when I think about that, because it's just, like, it's a dedication I am very scared of.
Is it working? Okay, cool. I was just going to say, like, I feel like, in my opinion, like, the best art I've seen, and, like, it is art that shows, like, or sheds some kind of truth. And it's incredible that, like, I think since, like, the aggressions where it's, like, Palestine, like, has escalated, I've been asking, like, a lot, like, what do I want to say? As an artist, too, like, I do think I do bear the responsibility of, like, shedding light on truth. And I had to ask myself, like, what do I want to say? It's the same that thing that you were saying, that, you know, like, what's the message that my art can convey that my, you know, like, language can't? And it is really powerful when you think about how, like, the nature of art to, like, be able to, like, sort of spread through and, like you know, break boundaries. And that is something that I, like, I'm thinking a lot about. Like, I sometimes see, like, art that people are making, and people that are not, like, you know, well-read on the, or don't really care about the cause. And it feels like it's devoid of any meaning if it doesn't reflect some kind of truth. And I think that dedication is so scary, but it's also, like, something that artists should all, like, strive to come close to, because that's the essence of it, you know?
Yeah, that's a fantastic point. Just jumping off of that, there is a particular power that art has compared to other kind of forms of information sharing when it comes to resistance. In that, you know, you can see a list of facts, you can see a list of statistics, and they may hit you, but they won't hit you as hard as maybe a story or a piece of visual art, because that has an emotional reality, and that connects more to us than, you know, maybe an article might. Ursula K. Le Guin has a really good essay about this. It's called From Elfland to Poughkeepsie. Would really recommend that one. But she talks about how stories can reflect reality a lot more, particularly genre fiction that she was talking about is more reflective than realistic fiction, because it is hyper-rational, and it is super reality in that way, that it hits you in the exaggerated way that we feel emotion, that can often be more heightened than what we are seeing in front of us.
And I think one thing that I'd like to kind of follow up on, like, when we're thinking about the impact of our art, and you can kind of speak to this in, you know, your more specific roles, but who is your target audience? Like, when we're thinking about the impact we want our art to have, like, do you want to be reaching as many people as possible? Do you want to be more specific in who we're targeting? And how do you actually achieve that reach? Like, how can we make those connections to people?
I think in the context of the stuff that we do, I think a lot of times art as resistance is almost the antithesis to whatever it's resisting. So I guess that scope kind of changes depending on who or what you're fighting. I guess in the specific context of Music Waste, I think its origin story is really representative of that, because it's it started as an anti-culture fest to Music West, which is what is now Live Nation's old music festival in, like, the 80s, that didn't let this man's local band in. So then it started off with, like, a basement show. But then it grew from there to what it is now, which is, like, a 50 to 70 band, fully anti-capitalist music festival. And I guess we're just the antithesis of, like, other festivals on a much larger scale that don't necessarily serve artists or community. But obviously that's just limited to our scope. Circling back to the general point, I think it really is dependent on the cause that art is fighting, and it is generally reflective of that on whatever scale that may be.
Yeah, and you can all feel free to answer either in your personal experiences or more kind of how you think about this more theoretically or abstractly. I really appreciated how you shared both.
Yeah, kind of jumping on the back of that, at Grey Lab, we are completely self-supported by our community. Everything we do is kind of to further the artists that we support. So oftentimes we're able to host either shows or certain types of music that are not allowed to be anywhere else, such as like extreme hardcore, noise, very, not outlandish, but kind of along those lines of art displays and things. And I think kind of what we do is we want to target everybody and then bring them into this community so these messages of resistance can be spread to a wider audience. Because otherwise, if everyone's fragmented, you're going to have to consistently reach out and slightly tweak your message over and over and over again. That's kind of where I stand with it.
I think the fragmentation point you brought up was a really important one, because so often in these spaces, so many people can have a common goal, but slightly different ways of getting to from point A to point B, or slightly different interpretations of what said common goal is. And we're so much stronger collectively, but oftentimes it's really difficult to get everyone on the same page. Not that everyone should be on the same page, because that difference in perspective is very important as well. But I guess that circles back to the limitations in art as resistance, is that everyone has their particular ways about going about things or interpreting things, and sometimes that can lead to detracting from the strength of collectivism that a lot of us possess.
I think, McMungo, you brought up kind of like one limitation that we should maybe keep in mind, which is, you know, you mentioned that you're community funded, but does resistance sometimes require these more institutional or formalized resources in order to actually have the capacity to be achieving these goals?
I would disagree. It highly depends on how big your community is and what the factors that you need to hit are. Like, we have a certain rent we need to pay every month. How can we incorporate this level of resistance while still engaging the capitalist element of, you know, paying our landlord and everything else? But at no point do we reach out to institutions, whether it's for grants or anything else, to get there. And I think, yeah, it's just very, very highly dependent on how big your support base is and how much they are willing to support you.
Yeah, I mean, I think, thank you for sharing that, because I'm always a and, like both, all of the above kind of person. And I so appreciate the community elements that are so necessary because of the ways in which institutions can and do often co-opt, right? So if a movement or art is a form of resistance in whatever shape that takes, especially in anti-capitalist kind of initiatives that get co-opted by capitalism, by these institutions. But I also think there is something to, for example, using some of that funding to your benefit to maybe support others who perhaps don't have maybe the same kind of momentum or, you know, visibility. So I think it's that those contradictions that we're always met with, and I think context absolutely matters. But I think it's like a and both all, because I think increasingly it seems like the worlds we're living in, resources or sources or just communities being separated by some of those divisions as well, that I don't know if an institution has money, I might just want to take it just to do the very thing it doesn't want me to do. I don't know.
Jumping off of that, I kind of am also a both sort of person, but I was thinking of is art as an invitation to build community and how art can bring community together. But that's like, I feel like something we understand and live if we're here, either as panelists or as audience. But then I was also thinking, like, the capacity for you to not rely on institutions is also dependent on how ingrained and involved with your community you are. Mm-hmm. If you're just creating art on your own, even if it's like maybe the most, I don't know, whatever sort of form of resistance, or if you're not involved in your community, you can't be truly anti-capitalist, because there is, like, it's your community who will uphold you and support you. If your art doesn't speak to your community, then is your art really for that community? Or are you sort of like, we get into these questions of co-optation. which are really difficult. So I was thinking about that. And then a super final note I wanted to add to the question of audience. There's a, like I mentioned before, art is an invitation. So it's an invitation to all. It's super, as an overthinker, it's overwhelming for me to think like, is this saying what I want to be saying? But the way I feel most free in my creative flow is to be like, and you've probably heard this before, but it's to kind of like disregard that a little bit. And there's also a question of, there's this essay called Changing the Interlocutor by Dabashi. I don't remember their first name, but they say, we must change the interlocutor essentially from institutions to another one, to someone who understands anti-capitalist struggles, to someone who understands anti-imperialist struggle. So personally, in my poetry and in my works, I try to speak to that and to people who will walk in the open door, which I've tried to hold.
Yeah, I really love that image that you put, but like holding the door open for others. And I think something that that's been like a very important part in the project that we're doing at Anarchist. We're also like a self-funded, completely supported by community. We just do fun little workshops and try to get like, you know, we incorporate art, but then we also like, it's kind of like, let's get together and learn about this new thing. And so much of what I've like just noticed is that a lot of people actually want to help and want to get involved, especially like in this increasingly like individual kind of, you know, like just society that we're living in. But one interesting thing I've realized is people are also like scared, because as much as I feel like this space is like beautiful, and pushing towards like something really important, there are like, I've noticed there's like a certain level of like judgment when working around these organizations, and there's this fear of like saying the wrong thing. Mm-hmm. And I think like as creators of space, as holders of space, we also need to hold the door open for those who don't know what, like, you know, the correct terminology for things, and that are first, you know, it's their like first introduction to. And that's been very like interesting, because once you actually build that trust, once you tell someone like, you can mess up here, it's okay. The goal is to like learn together. That's when that support comes to. We just wrapped up a little project that we were doing called the Ramadan Project, where we were just, a bunch of us just got together, made food like every weekend. And yesterday we made and distributed 40 meals completely with ingredients donated like by people. We didn't have to, you know, it was truly such a community effort. And I think one thing I'd like to see more of in art spaces is just that, reassurance that if you mess up or if you don't know anything, that you're not going to be villainized for it. Yeah, holding the door open, as you said.
Yeah absolutely. This just, I have so many thoughts in my head. I think the library as a concept is a really interesting example to put through this, because many libraries are state run. The history of the library is not blameless. There is a lot of messy stuff going back to discrimination and particularly like propaganda in libraries. But, you know, they are also a symbol of freedom. They're one of the last free third spaces that we have. And you know, out on the shelves particularly, we have kind of a complicated relationship to like institutions and funding as well, because we are also completely donations and volunteers run. We don't have money for rent right now. The place we are in is kind enough to let us stay because they're good people. But, you know, we're very vulnerable to that. So if we lose our space, we lose our collection. We have a very large collection of very old and often rare books that are really hard to find. And if we lost our space back in 2016 when the place we were in downsized, and I don't know how many we lost then. And I really, really would rather that not happen again, because we're always rebuilding and losing and rebuilding again. So I think that is kind of, you know, the inherent way that these kind of institutions get run, but it would be nice to have that kind of stability. All the same, I think it's important to maintain independence for these kinds of, for the art to remain resistance, because, you know, we have a lot of different books. We have a lot of books that, you know, may not be so kosher for, you know, how many queer people think about their sexuality today, but it's important. It's part of our history. And I think it's important to remember that that kind of moral purity is impossible. So we just have to keep buggering on the best we can.
Yeah. The point of giving people grace to grow in spaces is so, so important, and is one that I too feel is often lost in spaces slash can be difficult to wrap your head around when you're first entering a space and you're not comfortable or you're not sure. I really love what you said about like establishing that trust and that being the catalyst to people growing collectively. And I think that that in and of itself would solve the issue of like fragmentation and collectivism that I was talking about earlier, but is much easier said than done. Especially in the individualist world that we live in, people are raised their whole lives to think individualistically to some extent. I too think that, this is a side tangent slash a separate point, but, oftentimes, I think that organizations, movements, etc., there's, especially maybe even in the context of art, but there's almost this pressure to constantly grow, and I feel like that's like a byproduct of capitalism, and especially when things like funding or other barriers exist to the various movements, I think it's important for people to internalize and understand that the scope of which you're doing things can always grow and change, and it doesn't have to constantly be getting bigger. It can get smaller, it can stay the same. And that's a reflection of the resources you have, the capacity you have, the manpower you have. In the context of Music Ways, something that organizers that have existed passing down to organizing teams year after year have always emphasized is that just because we have a 50-band music festival now doesn't mean that we have to next year. It can be a 3-band show. It could be a 1-band show. Like, whatever people have the capacity to commit to or put forth, whatever's a representation of what people feel or what people are doing is more than okay. And that, yeah, things don't always have to grow. Things can get smaller, things can exist as they are.
Well, one thing that I think that you're kind of really bringing up there is, you know, placing yourself and your work and your resistance and not necessarily giving into these institutional or individualistic demands. Do any of you have any more thoughts about kind of how you and your work is in relation to these kinds of pressures?
Sorry, it's just... yeah, I'm for this exhibition, I talked about it's Youth Ignite Festival, and they pay me, I was thinking throughout this whole thing, like, I feel like I need to do something with the money. It's not that much, it's $400 to create and then $100 to put it up. I feel it's important to be transparent about money, especially in when we talk about anti-capitalist struggle, ironically. But I was thinking, like, last week I was so frustrated with institution, and I stopped myself from swearing there. but I felt it coming. I was so frustrated with institution, and I have just like, I think it's a page that it just says like, create, take $500 and an opportunity. And then I don't know, it's something like, just pick up your pencil, just pick it up. And then there's like, it's just super big, because this is how I felt it and wrote it in my notebook. It's just like, pick it up. And that's like, sometimes I feel like that hostility is something that institutional pressures and demands put in us. And for me, that comes out in my work. And it comes out also sometimes, sadly, in how I approach conversations and people. I'm talking about making mistakes and moving forward. I know about maybe like 6 months ago or a year ago, I would be having so much more hostile conversations about resistance and change than I would right now. And giving grace to others and oneself as an artist, as a person, is... for me, a lifelong journey. Like, music waste gets smaller and bigger and smaller and bigger and smaller and bigger, my capacity for grace does the same, and all does. So kind of like situating ourselves in those ebbs and flows, which I mean are all around us. There's a reason why there's change just all the time.
I think kind of adding on to that point a little, our space exists in very much a gray area when it comes to legality. There are certain permits and things you have to operate a venue of any sorts. And in order to get them, you have to have huge amounts of capital. We don't have those available. So our very existence puts us in kind of a place of hostilities with the institution itself, be that law enforcement or bylaw officers or any of that sort of thing. And because of those kind of hostilities, we also have to dial back certain things that we'd like to do when it comes to artistic expression. Like, we have to be very careful with our noise. We have to be very careful when we do things. We have to be very careful how we publicly push those things out. And I think just if those barriers just came down a tiny bit and capital wasn't such a driving factor of art spaces nowadays, whether through rent or entry fees or anything else, it would make the act of art as a resistance a much more widely seen practice, instead of one that encourages you to have all these financial backings before you can, you know, express this art, such as what you were saying with the poetry grant, I believe. And I feel like if those barriers, again, were dropped, it would make the entire thing a lot easier and a lot more productive.
Just a question, like, what do you think is required to drop those barriers? Like, can, yeah.
In that case, a lot of the red tape around certain buildings that you can use, areas, zoning laws, those would be huge. There's also a lot of things regarding inspections that need to be done, where there's an understanding of safety, absolutely, but in certain cases they are either, when you say a venue, they believe, okay, you're going to have like 150 people in there, all of them are getting absolutely wasted, like, how are you going to account for those people, right? And there's just certain small requirements that they have to enforce on you that become extremely difficult to hit for people without a large source of finance.
I think something about DIY spaces is, like, you know, dealing with these struggles is so, can be so frustrating. I find myself also, like, dealing with a lot of, I think as artists, we're just very, like, sensitive too. So we kind of, like, everything that we create, like, it just, we channel that frustration in our art too. And I think that's a beautiful thing. But I've also, like, thought about how, like, I carry, like, a lot of guilt sometimes in creating the space too, because I know there's always something that we can do better, and it's so lovely to be surrounded by, like, you know, such beautiful, like, people, passionate people that are, like, you know, driven towards the same cause. But I also wanted to say that, like, I think there are so many levels and layers to, like, disruption. And something that has helped me sort of deal with the sort of cognitive dissonance, like, oh, like, I want to be away from this, but I'm also complicit in it, is to, like, recognize that, and this gets kind of existential, I get kind of existential here, but, like, to recognize that I think we live, like, we're living in, like, a very, like, this existence is paradoxical. And I think the solution is not, like, there will never be, like, a place where we can, you know, reach that, like, perfect balance of, like, that the thing that we're trying to strive for. So the best we can do, I feel like, or at least what I believe, is, like, trying to fight it in the ways that we can, while at the same time being, like, compassionate with ourselves too, and realizing that, you know, for what we, like, in one area, if we lack something in this area, we can make up for it in another way. That's something that I've been thinking of, and I hope that you guys as artists as well, like, are compassionate with yourselves and recognize the fact that you hold a lot of power, but you don't need to, you know, feel the guilt that comes with it. If sometimes you have to, you know, give into funding or give into institutions.
I really appreciate all of your honesty about like the guilt and the frustration that sometimes comes with this work. And I think when we have these kinds of conversations, it's also really important to highlight the other side of the coin. And I think what you're talking about there, Lisa, about, you know, making sure that there's still energy for yourself. And so I kind of want to just take some time to highlight that and ask you all, you know, what does provide you the energy to sustain your labor, your activism, and, you know, what is the most fulfilling aspects of your work?
I'll just start as faculty, and I'm far less an artist than folks here, and I'm so appreciative of your sentiments, your reflections, and kindness. It's this, honestly. Like, I'm always energized, especially teaching in an institution. And for years now, I think it's becoming incredibly more and more apparent just how the amazing work you're doing that only lets me know the amazing work that is yet to come. And I think that comes back to those conversations around resistance, because I don't think you all are accepting things. I know you're not. You're telling us you're not accepting things the way they are. And I really incredibly appreciate your conversations or how you're thinking about grace for yourselves and for others, because I think that is often what can be missing, or, you know, something, those frustrations and where those hostilities can and do emerge. And so just thinking about generations and just, yeah, that sort of, you know, while sometimes things can be challenging and difficult and you need that time and whatever that looks like and in what ways and what spaces and contexts, but that sort of not accepting things, I think, is so incredibly energizing. It's laborious, of course. It's a lot of labor. But it's that will, you know, that I think is, yeah, I think it's incredible.
Yeah, for me, a lot of it is just being able to immediately see the work that I do pay off. I'm a librarian. I love cataloging and organizing and labeling things. And so part of my work at Utz has been helping with our metadata, making our books more findable, more usable. And just the moments of joy when someone comes in and I can look up something in the catalog, or I can point out to the shelves and I can show them exactly what they're looking for, and they go out of the library with a smile on their face and a book in their hands. And that just brings me so much joy, especially looking at, you know, this is something I wished I'd had when I was young, and that means so much. The other thing is that, like I said before, this library's been around since 1983, and it has never had any formal funding or formal space. It has just been people going back years and decades by the skin of our teeth working on this thing. I got the opportunity a couple weeks ago to go to the Vancouver City Archives and look up some of our old meeting minutes and documentation, and just seeing all the voices of those people and their jokes and their relationships, that's incredibly, incredibly amazing.
I got super excited when you asked the question, because I love the struggle. I love it. I love what it does. I love thinking about it. I love creating around it. I love being with people who care about it too. I love being connected to all, like, it makes me so emotional. But to think about the fact that to be in struggle today is such a blessing and such an opportunity to be connected to all who have been in struggle for years, like you were talking about, like to be a part of a legacy of change, facing something so massive, so expansive, so ancient too, and so soul crushing. It's just very beautiful to be. I think it's very beautiful and sometimes really, really hard, but it's such a blessing. That gives me a lot of energy, and it makes me very emotional to just like think about just the legacy that I am a very, very, very small part of. And it's, oh, I just got super excited.
That was very well said, Nico. I think thinking about, like, partially in thinking about that legacy, but partially also in feeling the despair of, like, there's so much work we have to do, and how could we ever get close to even beginning to feel okay? I think for me, like, coming from someone who's, I think, more in, like, music spaces, is there's, like, I feel like being in community with people at a concert or whatever has a tremendous healing power that I think also, like, is really important for keeping you motivated, and also just like as a source of like, here's a bunch of people around me who all care about a similar thing, and maybe right now we're all tired and we've all given so much, and maybe right now we're just gonna be in community and listen to music. I think on a, a sort of a different interpretation of how art can be used, but I think just as like an emotional release is a huge thing too.
I was just gonna say, yeah, like I think I agree with all the answers, and I think there's something so beautiful about, you know, being like a small part of something so grand. We're like such, we're, you know, social animals. We need community, and it's like when I see like people come to our events, and with the same like with the passion, that the same passion that I have, it's always, it feels like a hug. You know, it feels like coming home. And I love that little comment that you said about like, you know, just it's sometimes it's also like celebrating. You have to celebrate the small wins. You know, we've had like people come to our events who didn't know anything, like didn't know that Palestine was a country. And they left knowing like, you know, a little bit more about the cause. So it's like one of those things where it might sometimes like in like circles of activism, I also see that we really want to see, and it's so understandable. Because we're so passionate and we care so much, we really want to see big changes. But a lot of times, change, especially change that is sustainable, you see it in like smaller, like you see it incrementally. And you have to recognize those wins, and you have to pat people on the back for learning something that they didn't know yesterday. And I think that's so important. That's also the thing that I think ultimately determines whether or not a movement stays or dies, is if you need to, I know like some, there's a lot of like, I know like people say like, oh, like I don't want to spoon feed, and that to each their own. But for me personally, like let me feed you like several spoons, you know, let me feed you a whole meal, because I think that's how we keep it going.
As we kind of, you know, near the end of our time here today, I want to thank you all so much for coming out and being here, sharing your opinions, your perspectives. Your words have been so impactful, not only for me, but for everyone live here with us today and live listening. And I really just want to give a final opportunity for you to sort of like uplift your own movement. So if you have any current ongoing projects or anything you'd like to highlight, please take the time. Draw attention to yourselves. No shame.
Okay, hi. We speaking for Grey Lab, we have a live music fundraiser weekend coming up that will just help us prepare for summer, getting AC units, upgrading our bathrooms a little bit, just doing things like that. Coincidentally, I think it also coincides with Music Waste, so that's going on as well. So big heads up for that. Two awesome things coming out.
I guess that was my jump in for me. yeah, Music Waste is June 5th to 8th this week. This year. It's the first weekend of June. Multi-venue festival. Come out. We have lots going on. It'll be really fun.
We have a book club this Sunday called Barely a Book Club. and it's a very casual conversation on, we, you know, discuss, well, I don't lead it. My lovely, scholar baddies, Atisha and Cushy, they lead it. And yeah, every book club is dedicated to like looking at works, from historical revolutionaries, present day revolutionaries. So yeah, come through. Free food and lots of good chats and books.
Did you say books? Yeah, wonderful. So speaking of books, we have our volunteer intake coming up early May. We're going to be looking for new volunteers to help us run the circulation desk. So if you're interested, check out our website, outontheshelveslibrary.com. Email us at outontheshelveslibrary@gmail.com. We also have our catalog up on the website if you want to search our collection. Even if you don't have time to volunteer, that's no worries. Come in, make a library card. We want to show you our collection. We also do gaming with Out on the Shelves if we have any RPG fans out there. And a seed library. We have a bunch of seed bombs in the library that our seed librarians made. So grab them and let's seed bomb Vancouver.
I love guerrilla gardening. Oh, yeah. Sorry, I completely spaced out. There's a May 14th thing. I will be exhibiting my works, but only come to that if you like my poetry and like check it out when I post it, because my Instagram page at the moment is just blank. This is a very new and overwhelming thing for me. But more importantly, Rooting Resistance in Action. It's an event series we've been doing with Unceded Airwaves, the Indigenous Radio Collective here at CATR. It's a 3-day series. Also, we've been doing it with anarchists and a lot of support from a lot of fronts. And it's sort of like grounding land defense movements. We're going to be looking at shorts. We do zines while we look at the shorts and then discuss. There's food. We try to make it cozy and nice lighting. It's a space to introduce yourself to people who care about these things. Tomorrow specifically, we're looking at, it's the last day, so we're looking at land defense around the globe. We're going to be looking at Palestine. We're looking at indigenous so-called Australia. We're going to be looking at the Zapatistas in southern Mexico and Chiapas. And we're also going to be looking at the Philippines. There's a short for each of them, and we have guest speakers for tomorrow, SPHR, Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights. Sorry, I'll stop plugging it because it feels like it's gone too long. But at Unseated Airwaves on Instagram, and you'll find it everything.
All right. Well, then I think with that, we're coming to a wrap with the live broadcast of our Everything But the Panel. So thank you so much once again to all of our panelists. We are so proud to have you here today. And thank you, everyone at home, for tuning in. But everyone who is here live, please feel free to stick around. We're going to have a social hour where you can ask even more personal questions. And that is it for our series. Oh, that is it for our series, Everything But the Peace. Thank you.
This is John M. Bennett, and you are listening to CITR FM 101.9 in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada.
We're good, great, and you're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver's home of rock and roll.
Is the simple joy of riding a bike missing from your life? No worries. Ride On Bike Shop has got you covered. Ride On has the best deals in town for new and used bikes, top-notch servicing, and all the parts or accessories you've been dreaming about. Whether you've got a little one who needs to learn how to ride, or if you're about to go on the Tour de France, Ride On is the place for you. We'll also happily pick up your old bikes and recycle them back into the community. Located on